Since March 2009, the Pharmacy Podcast has been developing content monthly, weekly, and daily for the business of pharmacy. With more than 25 different podcast channels, more than 1 million downloads, and 30-plus participating pharmacists, the Pharmacy Podcast Network is the global leader in podcasting for the pharmacy professional. Find all of our podcast channels by going to pharmacypodcast.com/shows.
Welcome to the V3 Podcast with Dr. Ann Arvizu. Medical affairs innovators are changing the game for business success and making the world a better place for our patients. On the V3 Podcast, we showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. Each month, join host Dr. Ann Arvizu, a globally recognized medical affairs subject matter expert and awarded biotech industry executive veteran, for powerful interviews with today's acclaimed innovators and founders who are leading the profession forward into a new era. These high-level conversations will leave you inspired and equipped with future-focused ideas for changing culture and making an impact. And now, here's Ann.
All right, everybody, welcome to the V3 Podcast. This is the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. And I'm your host once again, Dr. Ann Arvizu. And I want to welcome my friend and esteemed guest here, Darshan Kulkarni. We went to pharmacy school together, so I know where he got his doctorate from. And he's got like this other doctorate. He's also a lawyer and he's got his master's in regulatory affairs. So when you talk about the MLR in MLR, he has all of them. He's got the M with his PharmD, he's got the L with his legal degree, and he's got the R with his regulatory. So he's like a one-stop walking MLR machine for the pharmaceutical industry. I love that. He's got a great podcast. It's also on the Pharmacy Podcast Network. So I'll shout that out because I think the name of it is so cute. It's called The Gavel and the Pestle. I think that's just adorable. And so, you know, I'm coming from the medical affairs background within the pharmaceutical industry. We're going to have a great conversation today, Darshan and I, about, Darshan, we're going to be talking about, are sales reps allowed to give off-label information to doctors when they're visiting? So I want to set that up. So first of all, before we dive in, let me set that up from a medical affairs standpoint. From a medical affairs standpoint, within our industry, we have a couple of functions that keep us compliant. And I mean us, meaning our entire company, our entire industry. So if you're a medical information department within the pharmaceutical industry, or if you are the MSLs, those are the medical science liaisons, right? Or they're the field medical team or the field medical reps, whatever pharmaceutical companies call them, mostly MSLs these days, back in the day, 10, 15 years ago, they would be known as regional medical scientists, et cetera. But these people are PharmDs, a lot of PhDs, and sometimes nurses, depending, you know, oncology, pediatrics, et cetera, sometimes MDs as well. They are scientists that would go and talk to a scientist. So from an off-label perspective, if somebody visiting a doctor in the field was to receive an inquiry, a medical information inquiry, they can verbally answer while they're there with a doctor or their caregivers or their team or staff at a hospital. They're allowed to talk about a non-labeled use. So this term of a non-labeled or unapproved use refers to something that's not included in the labeling, the package insert, which is approved by the FDA. So it's an intended use that's not included in indications that FDA has given you an okay. You've given, you know, a device or marketed authorization or a drug that has an intended use, and it doesn't fall within that exemption or category under Section 510 of Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So we all have, if within our industry, whether you're internally, and when I say internally, you are a internal company employee working within medical information, and you're allowed to, in a written letter, give a fair, balanced response to an unsolicited question, to a question that comes in, and maybe that question might have something to do with an unapproved use. Now, in the U.S. and Canada, doctors use this all the time, right? They're not going to stop the flow of medicine for using a drug or drug product for something that might have a beneficial effect on a patient, and they're using it off-label because maybe this particular, and I'll give you a great example. I had been working on a fluoroquinolone years ago with SmithKline Beecham. The drug was called Factiv, and it was being initially studied for use in AECB, acute exacerbations of chronic bronchitis, as well as CAP, community-acquired pneumonia, etc., a couple other indications. But there were other fluoroquinolones out on the market at the time, and those fluoroquinolones maybe were used for other purposes. So a doctor could say, hey, if yours, it's not indicated for this yet, only because FDA didn't give you clearance for it, but it doesn't mean I can't use it for that. So they might, in their clinical judgment, decide to use this for a non-labeled use. So that's what that means. So I just wanted to set that up for our listeners who maybe are new PharmDs, they're thinking about the pharmaceutical industry, or just someone who's passing by, because we did have a lot of listeners on our first couple of shows, and I would love to hear some comments from you below. We'd like to really have a chat about this one. This is a big topic. So Darshan, let's dive in a little bit. First, tell us about a little bit more about yourself and your background and why we should listen to you, because I absolutely love talking with you. And the last time we were on the phone, we were on for a long time and we had a great conversation about this. So tell us about, let's open it up to you.
Sure. So first of all, thank you again for having me. And it's good to reconnect. It's good to talk. And yeah, I mean, I have my own podcast, like you mentioned. I'm doing the Gavelin Pestle, but I also have my own podcast called Darshan Talks. Mm-hmm. So if you look that up on, I think it's on iTunes as well, and on Stitcher and a couple of the other ones, and also on YouTube as well. My background, like you mentioned, I'm a PharmD JD with the MS in Quality Assurance Regulatory Affairs. And I've clerked for a federal court judge, so I understand not just how rules get interpreted and written out, but how do judges actually see that? Do they see them with the same fine-tuned comb that that lawyers look at these things? Lawyers come at these things with the idea that the judge is going to look at the history of this and it's going to be extremely well-versed in how we think in the industry. Mm-hmm. And my experience is interesting when it relates to that. We can have a whole other discussion when it comes down that path. And I also have a fellowship in interprofessional geriatric care from Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. University Hospital. So I tend to get into that. I've worked over 20 years in pharmacy in various capacities, from working in large academic institutions to literally being a pharmacist, one of four pharmacists, and the hospital literally had four patients. So yeah. I've done that whole gamut, and I've worked in retail for 10 years. And I know it sounds like I'm probably 92 years old. But I've sort of done a lot of this stuff while simultaneously practicing law and having my own law firm. I was corporate counsel for a pharmaceutical company that worked in both generics and in bringing branded products to market, whether it was drugs, devices, or other stuff as well. So what I have is a regulatory law practice that gets into weird, unusual, sort of cutting edge work, everything from off-label discussions, which is the core of what we're going to discuss today, mm-hmm. to genomics and to 23andMe and what is the implication of that, and pharmacogenetics, and I mean, I can keep going to medical marijuana, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's one of those cutting edge, super fun places where you're going anti-aging therapies and you're going, what does this actually mean? But that's sort of my history, if you will. You raised a few interesting comments that I'd love to talk about and contextualize, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Please do.
So one of my favorite ones that really throws people off is you've done this for a while, and so you're what I would refer to as an expert in this field. So, mm-hmm. And this is sort of a trick question, so I'm just warning you up front.
Okay.
Is label and labeling the same thing?
Is label and labeling the same thing? No.
How are they different?
The label is the label. It's sure. After the labeling has taken place. That would be my quick answer. The labeling is the process. Although, you know, if you think about the guidance document, they say this is not included in the labeling. So that is actually the language they use. So I'd love to hear your differentiation on it.
Yes. So so let's go back to what the FDA's goal is. The FDA has only, literally its jurisdiction falls into two main categories. That you can do two things and you cannot do two things. As long as you do and not do those four things, you're fine. The FDA's job in the case of drugs is to make sure that your product is safe and efficacious, mm-hmm. and it's not adulterated, misbranded. So the label on a bottle is the label, as you pointed out, it's the package insert or whatever it is. Labeling, unfortunately, is not what you would think of. It's not the process of attaching the label.
Okay.
Labeling is anything that goes with the bottle, basically. And the word goes with is extremely broadly defined. So what your sales rep says goes with the bottle. Mm-hmm. Therefore, your sales materials are labeling. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where the Supreme Court came out. And that's why if your sales rep speaks off label, is probably part of the labeling of the bottle. And does that render your product mislabeled?
And that is a huge question for our industry. And I think we need to let our listeners hear a bigger view, because if you are a medical information person or you're in the medical affairs side, you know, you really kind of know that we have a guidance for industry, and we'll talk about the guidance. You and I talked about it before, but we're going to open this conversation up, that the guidance for industry, that's sort of our gold standard internally, that talks about distributing scientific and medical publications. And, you know, what are the recommended practices? What are the unapproved new uses? What are we going to do with that? Those procedures were originally published by the FDA, and we'll put a link to them for our listeners in February of 2014. Then they were revisited because of a lot of noise out there. Because at one point it was sales reps are not allowed to speak about anything but the label. So if they are then, therefore, what you're saying, able to speak about other uses that are not included in the labeling that's been approved by the FDA.
By the label that's been approved by the FDA.
Right. Okay, because I'm actually reading from the FDA memorandum, and they use the word, they do use the word labeling. So it's confusing for us, right, in the industry of what they can and can't do. So tell us about some of those cases that came up that pharmaceutical industries are, you know, they're kind of actually talking to the FDA and saying, let our sales reps talk. And we didn't even know this. I didn't even know this until you and I had this conversation.
So I think what's really useful is to sort of contextualize all of this, which is why otherwise it seems like things came out of nowhere. So I'd like to sort of see a little bit of the history of this.
Yeah.
What I like to think about is, do you sort of know where the entire medical affairs function came about from?
To keep the pharmaceutical industry compliant.
Fair enough. I'm sorry, this is me. I teach at the University of the Sciences.
Yep, where we both went.
Exactly. I teach bioethics, so I tend to have mm-hmm. this conversation. So I apologize if you weren't expecting to be put on the spot. It's a great conversation.
I'm interviewing you, Darshan. Give us some info. I know you're a podcaster too. This happens all the time with other podcasters.
It does. So anyway, I'll give the info out a little bit.
Okay.
Here's what it came down to. When you go back into the early 2000s and the like, the FDA started going after companies and saying, you know what, your medical affairs people are speaking off label. They're effectively working as supercharged salespeople. And that's problematic. And the industry said, well, wait a second, that's not exactly right. These medical affairs people are having, as you put it, a scientist-to-scientist conversation. And the idea is, it is, under the First Amendment, it is protected speech. And the idea is that as long, there are certain categories of information that are not subject to censorship. An example of that is political speech. You can't shut down Trump from saying something. You can't shut down Hillary Clinton from saying something just because you don't like what they're saying.
Right.
So in the same way, you can't shut down two scientists from talking to each other. So that's sort of where that basis came about. And the FDA went to court with the pharma companies, and they lost the first case. And when they lost, they kind of went, okay, maybe we don't want to pursue this too far. And that's where you sort of got that the MSLs and the medical affairs function can exist as long as it's a scientist-to-scientist discussion, which is why you typically see your terminal degrees being used.
Right.
There's very little argument that someone with a PhD who's talking to another PhD is engaging in a scientific discussion.
Right.
Now, except we've had cases like that, and we'll talk about those a little bit further. But
okay. Quick question.
Yes.
Just to put it into context, are you talking when that whole thing, because remember, like we think, oh, that was about 10 years ago. That was about 10, 15, 20 years ago. In 1997, Congress passed FDAMA, right? The Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act.
Yep.
And also another thing that, you know, we go by in the industry is the 21 CFR Part 99. So mm-hmm. we have these different publications from FDA and these different sort of vague documents, because people have been trying to interpret them for years, which is why I think a conversation with someone like you is really, really beneficial. That this is the conditions under which a drug or medical device manufacturer could choose to disseminate medical and scientific information. So whether that's an approved use or an unapproved use, this is usually the type of conversation that you just talked about, healthcare professional to healthcare professional. So we've established that in the industry. And now it seems, based on our last conversation together that people haven't heard yet, which is coming, that it's possible, and it does look like, per these new updates to guidelines that we're seeing, that it's allowable that sales reps might be able to have these conversations. But I can't even wrap my head around letting that happen. I would have to say, you know, if you asked me, I would have to say the definitive no, they can't do that, right? Because especially if you are using context that it could actually cause some kind of, this is part of the label or part of the labeling, whatever the right language is, but this is an inclusion because they are speaking something about it.
Correct. So it would probably be part of the labeling. Or it might render your product misbranded is a nice way of sort of getting around the label versus labeling piece of it.
Now, nobody wants that.
Exactly. Nobody wants that because that's where you get the multi-billion dollar fines and and the criminal prosecutions and Park Doctrine and all that good stuff. But so let's sort of take that a little bit further.
Yeah.
So we heard about this whole medical affairs thing going on. We heard about medical affairs being able to now have this conversation as long as it's a quote unquote scientific discussion, and therefore you can get away with it and there's no problem. Here's the other interesting thing. You'll every so often get people saying, why doesn't the FDA stop doctors from prescribing off label? The answer to that is because the FDA has no jurisdiction over doctors.
Right.
So the reason I say that is because it's important to remember on-label marketing is totally legal. On-label prescribing is totally legal. Off-label use, so prescribing is completely legal, as you pointed out.
Yes.
But off-label marketing is not theoretically in.
Right.
Okay.
Right. The term is scientific exchange is what it has to be. And that's why I believe it's scientist to scientist and not right. able to be, because if a sales rep's job is inherently to market, then right. how can they even circumvent that, that kind of job description bullet point that really is part of what they do?
Right. So here's the real question. Can I take a scientist? So let's say Anarvizu, we say, you know what? You are now in charge of sales. You're a PharmD. You have a terminal doctorate. Why don't you now go talk to the doctors, speak off label? You're in charge of sales, but you should be covered because it's a scientist-to-scientist conversation. Is that okay?
No, it's proactive.
Okay, but it's still a scientist-to-scientist conversation, which would be covered. Right.
It is. There's scientific exchange. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if that would fall under this is education, because there's a fine line. Uh-huh. You were trained in the industry to respond unsolicited to an unsolicited request for medical information. And so if you're an MSL in the field talking to a doctor and they ask a question, that's unsolicited. Right. If you receive that question internally into a medical information department to maybe a frontline nurse at a contact center or an internal, you know, PharmD who is a higher level medical information specialist or manager in the industry, they are going to respond to the question that's asked. They're not proactively going out there to create information. Now, if you're going to a Congress and there's a way to present new data, that's education. And there might be those conversations that come up out of that data, or there could be case studies that have been published that are referenced, you know, maybe because there are investigators out there studying something for a new indication that's not out there yet. So I can't see where that would fall, to be very honest. I feel like there's gray areas right between those three distinguishing factors.
So that's sort of the gray area that the DOJ and the FDA try to go after. Well, tried to go after, really, more accurately. So what you really saw was a situation where pharma companies actually came out, and this is around 2011, 2012, I personally heard rumblings where companies would say, why don't we just take MSLs and supercharge them and essentially make them supercharge sales reps. Mm-hmm. And that's when you suddenly saw the GSK axe fall. You had a $3 billion fine, and you had the Merck and the Novartis, and, you know, like a whole bunch of them, multi-billion dollar fines. I think when I last looked, all the top fines that companies have paid have been from off-label marketing. Mm-hmm. And they're in the billions.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Right. It's that or scientific exchange review materials. Those are the two big ding marks.
Review materials would only be dinged if they were promotional in nature.
Right. If they had any form of claims.
Well, promotional. So it's not the claims part of it. So if it's pure scientific exchange, you'd be fine, because it's intended for scientist discussion. It's that next step where you're misleading people. And that's where the standard came in. I'm going to get to the standard a little bit. But here's sort of what happened. So your first court case that really started this whole thing was a case called IMS v. Sorrell. And it's, we all remember IMS. Do you remember IMS?
You sent it to me.
Okay.
so that's how I remember it.
Fair enough. So there's a company called IMS. Well, there was a company called IMS. And what IMS did was it would collect a whole bunch of data from a bunch of different people and give it to pharma companies. And I believe it was the state of Vermont that went to, and I'm now going to 2011, which is why my memory is a little hazy. But going back to 2011, the state of Vermont came out and said, no, you can't sell this data about our physicians to pharmaceutical companies, because that would cause these companies to target these doctors too much, and it might raise costs of prescribing in our states, and we don't want that. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically came out and asked a very simple question. The standard for giving people information is it truthful and not misleading? And Vermont said, no, it's truthful and it's not misleading, but there's a cost to it, and we don't want to bear that cost. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court came out and said, well, that's all well and good, but you can't stop people from saying something you don't like just because you don't like it.
Right.
If it's truthful and not misleading, you can't really stop people. So that was where the initial language came from. Then you had a citizen's petition filed by about, I think it was like 7 or 9 pharma companies, and I think a single medical device company that came together and said, oh, whoa, here's a Supreme Court decision. FDA, we want some guidance because this changes the ballgame. Because what happens if we can have these truthful and not misleading discussions? And it came out in the context of like things like social media and the like, but they were really going to this thrust of
right.
what constitutes truthful and not misleading. But before I go further, because this is where I think the real axe dropped, and we'll talk about that in a second. But when we talk about what constitutes truthful and not misleading for now in the, when you want to make a claim to the FDA, what does it take? Do you remember off the top of your head?
No.
Okay, cool. So to make a claim to the FDA basically requires you need 2 randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled studies.
Oh, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And I know you know that. I didn't just frame the question.
I only did it for 6 years. Okay.
Right. I just didn't frame it properly. But the idea here being, under the FDA standards, you need what's called substantial evidence. And substantial yeah. evidence is what I just described. If you want to make claims that are different, so for example, health economics claims, those would typically fall under what's referred to as the CARS standard, which is competent and reliable scientific evidence,
mm-hmm.
which is a much lower standard. You don't need the same type of rigor we just discussed. And that's typically what the FTC uses. And the reason that becomes important is because the definition of truthful and not misleading is sort of up in the air right now. No one really knows what those words mean. So we're now in 2011. You had the IMS v. Sorrell case. You now come to around 2012 or so. And you have a very interesting case come up. And this is the case of Alfred Koronian and what's now referred to as, well, Alfred Koronian, who worked for Orphan Medical. And Orphan Medical had a drug called Xyrem. Do you know which company I'm talking about yet?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to break that so that we can go from there?
Please keep going.
Okay, keep going. Okay. So Orphan Medical.
Walk us through these cases.
Yes, I'm sorry. I feel guilty just taking up too much airtime.
No, you're perfect. You're perfect. This is great.
Okay, perfect. So in the case of Alfred Koronian, he was a sales rep. He went and met a doctor, Dr. Peter Gleason, and they went to a doctor's office. Alfred Koronian sat in the corner, and Dr. Peter Gleason and this other doctor decided to have a conversation about the use of the off-label use and the reimbursement issues associated with Xyrem. Turns out that the doctor that Peter Gleason was speaking to was a plant from the Department of Justice and was wearing a wire.
Wow, yeah.
Yep. So this is like literally espionage kind of level stuff, which is kind of fun and all those good things.
Yeah, I think people don't know that this is happening out there.
Right. Well, it happened, but yes.
It did happen. Yes.
Yes.
That was a while ago.
Correct.
But still, not too far enough away for comfort.
Correct. It's what, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit longer than that, but yeah, plus or minus. So the question then became, okay, so Alfred Koronian didn't have the conversation, Peter Gleason did, but here's the question. Peter Gleason was a doctor. He was speaking to another doctor. Why would the DOJ try to prosecute that? Wouldn't that be covered under scientific discussion?
It's proactive. It goes back to that. And well, I don't...
You don't know if it was proactive, right? Yeah, they may have had...
There might have been a question leading up to that. You don't know if there was a conversation prior to that. There had to be something to get that person in the office.
Sure. The thing is, the proactive versus reactive thing is more of a guidance thing. It's not actually coming from the courts.
Okay.
So the FDA has sort of drawn that artificial line, but it's not as much
it's
of an
not
issue.
As strong as we think it is.
Correct.
Is what you're trying to say.
Correct. Thank you for framing it better than I can.
It's just something that it's almost, like I said, it's another, I'm going to use the word inconceivable again, because it's not the paradigm that we use, right?
Correct.
And it's certainly not the paradigm to go and be proactive or to create one thing. It just goes back to scientific exchange. I shouldn't be limited whether I'm in a company or out of a company, to state what I feel. But we, but there's a line that you can't cross, right? Right now, I can't, as a, if I'm putting the mindset on of an MSL, I can kind of say, okay, these are some case studies that might be interesting to you. That's scientific exchange, something that is a publication, something that has fair balance use, something that has already been published, or it's in a journal, something that I can, but if it's research information and it's coming from the company directly, you know, again, there's a fine line. So what exactly were they discussing?
So they were, like we discussed, they were sort of discussing the reimbursement issues is what I understand in that conversation. They were discussing how do you get paid for Xyrem?
Right.
And and Peter Gleason went down fighting and he said, to me, that is, I was having a scientific discussion. The Department of Justice disagreed. So Peter Gleason.
It's about pricing. I mean, it's about how to get paid or get it reimbursed.
Yeah, but I mean, around which disease state and the like.
Right.
So his position was, it's scientific discussion because it was scientist to scientist, and we were truly having a conversation about how the practice of medicine should occur, and this reimbursement is as much a practice of medicine as anything else. We expect to get paid. So that's where that came from. But the Department of Justice took the position that no, you were there with Alfred Coronia. You might be a doctor, but the fact was that you came in with a sales rep. Therefore, your actions were really more sales than as a physician.
Okay.
So the position, so the key thing to look at when I asked you the trick question earlier of can Ann Arvizu go out there and speak to speak as a salesperson for off-label uses? No, because you wouldn't be, your doctoral degree is not the decision maker, is not the deciding factor there. It's the role you play. And right. The role you play in that context is as a salesperson.
In that context.
Correct.
But in our industry, that's not, we're doing the opposite. There's a very strong line between commercial and between medical affairs. So the people listening in the medical affairs camp right now might be a little confused. I think we should kind of go into the fact that you had illuminated and sent me several cases to read.
Yep.
There are all kinds of cases coming from pharmaceutical companies petitioning the FDA that their sales reps should be allowed.
So we're going to get to that.
Okay, because that's really big. I think there's people going, what are they talking about? I don't even think this exists. It really does exist, and it's a thing, and it's out there, and I think that's what we need to illuminate next.
Right. So I think the key piece I was trying to point out is, you're right, that distinction between medical affairs and sales exists, and there's a reason you have that Chinese wall. And the reason you have that Chinese wall is because you want to split scientific discussion from sales conversations, because you have two totally different constitutional protections for both. Mm-hmm. And that's where that came from. And in the case of Alfred Coronia, you landed up in a scenario where Peter Gleason settled. He lost his license in the state of, I want to say, Florida. He then died, and then the state of Maryland took away his license in that order. which is one part.
Good thing they did that.
Was that?
It's a good thing they did that.
Yeah, right? You don't want a dead person going and doing inappropriate things. Then you had Orphan Medical became Jazz Pharmaceuticals and then settled.
Yeah.
But Alfred Coronia got a lawyer who I believe at that time was literally like 2 years out of law school. Mm-hmm. And so extremely inexperienced, but essentially the lawyer took it to court, and the court said exactly what we just said, which is, was what Dr. Peter Gleason said either not truthful or misleading? And the FDA couldn't say yes, because what they were talking about was something that the FDA approved the next year. So it was for an off-label discussion, and then the FDA went and approved it the next year for that information. And I believe it was in that case itself where the court said, so why can't they speak about it? Well, that's just not how it's done. Those claims are not approved by the FDA. And the court came out and said, the FDA places too high a value on its own importance. Mm-hmm. In those words, which I think is interesting. And then you had the Pacira case where the FDA had, again, a similar, was sort of sent a warning letter to Pacira for making claims that they didn't believe were true. Pacira sued them, and you had a similar situation again. And then you had the Amarin case, which had, Amarin wanted to make certain claims. They went to the FDA. The FDA said, you need to prove you need to do these studies. Amarin went out, did those studies, and proved what the FDA wanted. And the FDA then came out and said, yeah, we've changed our minds. The science has changed, so you can't make those claims. Amarin sued the FDA again in that specific situation and said, why can't we? The information was accurate. And the FDA's argument that things have changed is not good enough because we're talking about fish oils and you're letting other products, over-the-counter products, make the same claims.
Right.
So it's inappropriate and we actually have the evidence. So in each of those cases, what it came down to was the standard of you are allowed to speak as long as it, quote unquote, meets the standard of truthful, not misleading.
Okay.
And in throughout this process, industry's going out and filing citizens' petitions, industry's going out and filing memoranda, industry's going and suing the FDA. Essentially, the FDA had to sort of reassess what they were doing. And they couldn't hold on to this idea that this is how we've worked the process for the last 30 years. Because the court literally said a lot has changed in those 30 years, though, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where that came from. So medical affairs had this unique position of being the only people who could talk about things that were off label.
Right.
Here's the difference. In the future, the FDA put out a 64-page memorandum, which I know I'd sent to you.
Yep.
Where they said, here are, I think it was like 21 different ways we could deal with this situation, but we really don't know what to do right now. And that's really where we are at this second. They've held a public hearing, what's called a Part 15 hearing, and they asked for input. And the last time they had another hearing like this was on marijuana. And in the case of marijuana, the FDA said, we'll go through the usual rulemaking procedure that takes between 2 to 5 years to do. So I'm not expecting anything anytime soon on off-label.
Yep.
But the FDA, if you'll notice, has changed how they prosecute.
Yes.
So they aren't prosecuting based on off-label anymore. They're going after anti-kickback cases.
Right.
That's not to say that they won't. It just means that they are still figuring that piece of the world out. So going back to the question we were asking around medical affairs had the unique position of being the only people who could talk about off-label. What happens if a salesperson can speak to information that is off-label as long as it's truthful and not misleading?
Exactly. And going back to the FDA.gov site where you can find this link, right here in black and white, it's basically proving everything that you're saying. It says, although this draft guidance, which is still draft guidance, I guess it's always draft guidance, like the 2009 guidance, recognizes the value to healthcare professionals of truthful and non-misleading scientific or medical publications on unapproved new uses. It also continues to recognize that this information is in no way a substitute for the FDA pre-market review process, which allows FDA to be proactive rather than reactive in protecting the public from unsafe or ineffective medical products. So kind of to answer that question with a question, it just doesn't seem prudent at all. So if I was the sales rep, would I even want to? I guess, would I even want to put myself or others at risk in using this information? I think that if I knew that there was an off-label use and I'm a sales rep, should I be able to at least answer that? Then that would be truthful and not leading, right? They can't say, oh, I don't know. Because if they know, they can say, well, go to our medical information department or let me send an MSL to you or something to that effect, where a scientist to scientist scientific exchange conversation can go on. It just... I'm sorry, I just keep putting it back in that box, but I don't see that even if we played devil's advocate and sales reps were allowed to run amok and do the job of medical affairs, in my opinion, right? If they were able to just, but they still don't have the scientific background, so it doesn't make it scientific exchange.
It wouldn't be scientific exchange.
It wouldn't be scientific exchange, in my opinion. Yeah. And I guess that's how others would interpret it as well.
But I think what I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be scientific exchange. The courts aren't saying that it has to be scientific exchange. They're specifically saying commercial speech can be...
It's speech. It's freedom of speech. This correct. Is very interesting nuance that I think that a lot of people in the industry don't think of. How can we tighten up as an industry, based on what's out there and these laws that... laws, guidance documents, and then this memorandum, this 64-page memorandum, which we're going to give a link to our listeners so they can read it for themselves. There's some just absolute black and white statements that says, yes, we can't not only avoid the fact that sales reps could have these conversations, but it should it even be part of, is this better? I just can't even see that that's a way to go, that these conversations should be taken place by someone that doesn't have the scientific background, although they're getting trained really well. I don't know. What's your take on it?
So my take on it is whether or not we want it, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it won't happen right now is a very clear answer, which is we don't know what the words truthful and not misleading mean.
Okay. So it's too gray. And that's why companies would probably take the same stance that I take as, whoa, let's proceed with caution. Maybe there's some forerunners that might let their sales reps talk, but they would have to do so within dot, dot, dot. What? Is there some kind of maybe an FDA? Yes. Like a category, a box that they would be allowed to operate in, or is it just too gray?
When you say sales reps or they mean companies?
Yeah, sales reps.
Sales reps at this moment, theoretically, at this second, sales reps could speak off label. There's nothing that stops it.
And for me, that's the same thing, by the way. The sales rep really is representative of the company.
I'll tell you why I said that.
Right.
The reason I drew that distinction is because Amarin is actually promoting its product off label under FDA okay.
Under FDA, okay, through promotion with the sales reps. Wow.
It's on their website. You actually can go to their website. Again, I don't know
if
they have changed their marketing in the several years since then, but the FDA specifically wrote out saying, you are allowed to promote your product off-label. We're not going to change the label, but you can promote it off-label. We recommend that you run things by us, but we're not going to stop you. We're not going to change your label, but you can go ahead. So is it happening? It's already happening.
It's happening.
The real question is, I don't see big pharma changing. I do see the med device world, which is a little bit more of the Wild Wild West, changing. Taking this type of situation by the horns. And again, obviously not all medical device companies. I work with several who are very, very compliant. But the fact remains that there are going to be people who go, why do I even need a medical affairs function? Why can't I just have one guy who's a scientist and everyone else is a sales rep and you do your thing as long as you're speaking truthful and not misleading? The problem is no one knows what those words mean.
Okay.
But once the FDA defines and clarifies what those words mean, then you'll end up in a situation.
Then some standards, new standards can go into place for all of the different functions.
Correct. But here's the next question. What happens to medical affairs in that world? Why would someone keep medical affairs if sales reps can speak off label?
There's a couple of big buckets. Number one, there's been studies and there's been publications that, within the last 5 years that show that there's a decline in sales reps even being able to access physicians. Yep.
Absolutely.
That number two, physicians are looking
quick, quick question though. Is that necessarily places. Just sales reps or is it any industry personnel though?
Industry personnel in general, there's a lower trust factor. There's been a decrease in amount of medical information being accessed on websites that we can track. But there is a higher increase in the types of scientific exchange where doctors go to peer groups or or congresses and conferences. And so there are various functions within medical affairs that are very, very needed. And that the trust factor of the company seems to go up when different, when different polls come out, when there are more medical affairs team involved than less. So canvassing the field for scientific exchange, types of conversations that are held by MSLs is very different than you're locked out unless you just give me samples. And obviously that's just different, you know, because a lot of companies don't have the typical samples anymore. We're not talking everything's a pill. There are some very distinct type of gene therapies, new classifications, rare disease. And I think in those cases, and I spoke with FDA earlier this year in July in the rare disease conference up in Philadelphia specifically. And when they spoke, they really said, we want to, so to your point, get this information out. But this is still something that's in the process of getting approved. And there may be maybe shortening the time to approval for something that is a misdiagnosed disease, something that takes a long time to diagnosis. We're trying to care for the patient out there that doesn't have something. So in the case of, the website that you mentioned or the company you mentioned, Amarin, I go to their website and I would want to know, okay, point me to the information. I see full prescribing information here for a product called Vascepta. I see important safety information here. I see nothing that looks out of sorts. So
again, like I said, it's been several years since this, but they had officially, and I'm sure we could bring up the memo.
Okay.
They at one point had a banner on top.
Okay. They did. Because it does look approved now, but this is prior to approval.
New indications and everything since then.
A new indication, okay.
But I don't think it's the same indication that they aimed for then. So they were officially allowed to market for a totally different indication at one point.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's interesting. But it was allowed and it had FDA's blessing.
Yep.
So changes the game a little bit for people who are really kind of in a very compliant box within our industry. And I think it changes the conversation and maybe raises it to another level. Another thing that I think that I have seen lately is more conversations happening between medical affairs and FDA as to what can we do? Because part of medical affairs also is conducting post-marketing trials. Mm-hmm. So earlier when you used the word claim, I used the word claim in a different way, which is why I couldn't respond immediately to that question, right? For me, a claim is a misleading statement. Like I am claiming that this drug does this, and yet I don't have fair balance to back it up. You used the word claim as I'm going to get a claim to the FDA. That is for us, you know, the clinical trial package that's submitted to FDA to get that approval. It's a whole process that goes along with it. For people that don't understand the scientific process that goes into, you know, sometimes 10 years of studying a drug, of phase one, phase two, phase three, phase 3B, if needed, right? If the FDA wants something else, phase 3B, it's in a large number of patients. They're really the subset of the population that's about to take that product into their body, and then it's given approval. After approval, phase four, those studies are conducted within medical affairs. So that's yet another area that we do in medical affairs. The medical communications, the medical publications, none of that's going to go away. And there's a lot of data also showing that MSLs, the more MSLs, the higher the trust factor for the company. So tons of stuff out there. Everybody's searching for the same info for their business cases to increase their headcount, to help their medical affairs departments, and to really do what we're there to do best, which is be the expert of that drug and handle that in the most scientific and the most ethical way that we possibly can. Nobody signs up for medical affairs and says, okay, we are going to be here to do something wrong. We're like the police force in the industry, and that's what I've always called us, sort of in an off, just my term for it, right? I think that nobody else would necessarily say that, but because there is a functional department within companies called compliance, as you know, there is a functional department that's legal in a company. And this is for people outside the industry looking in. We have a lot of stops in place to make sure what we're doing is good and worthy and bringing what my heart is for patients, the right drug to the right patient at the right time, right? So that's what we all feel as healthcare professionals. A sales rep getting into a company, going into a compliant practice within commercial, is just doing what they do best, and that is promoting something. And it just happens to be that they're promoting a drug. So Darshan, what's the way forward for our industry in light of all this data that you've brought to the table today?
So I think the key piece as you continue is going to be being careful. If you are a conservative company, you're probably more likely than not going to change how you do business. If you are a more, shall we say, aggressive company, I would recommend significant amounts of education, significant amounts of training, significant amounts of compliance to make sure that your sales reps are staying on point. Mm-hmm. And sales reps are sales reps, and you're incentivizing them in many ways to push your sales. So sometimes it's one of those situations where they don't know what they don't know, and they may be saying things that sound completely accurate to them, but I've seen situations where MSLs would go, I hate walking with that salesperson because he or she doesn't know what they're saying, and I cringe at the comments they're making.
That's scary, and shouldn't even be happening. A lot of companies that I know and work with, and I know you're like me, you consult to the industry.
Right.
There is a very clear firewall. They do not have really contact with each other except for how to fill this MRF in.
Yep.
If you have a medical information request form, that's what the MRF is. Yep. If you want to fill this in properly, this is how to get it to either me or directly to medical information. Medical information might circle it back in the, you know, for the purposes of closing the loop, may circle it back and say, this is the letter that I sent to, you know, respond to that unsolicited request for medical information. And then they let the MSL know. The MSL maybe have another touch for value to the physician, but the sales rep shouldn't be part of that and should not be really part of. We're not riding together in the car. We're not going together. I don't know many sales reps or I don't know any MSLs that take their sales reps along with them for car rides or go together or create those, you know, lunch and learns anymore. It's just not the way it's done. There was that at one time, but it's just, I see that happening less and less. And I feel that companies are in what you're talking about, like really going towards something more conservative, because I think the big question that lingers is how would they even let their reps do this? I mean, you just illuminated an entire industry through this podcast today that says, oh, guess what? Did you know that in the nuances of all these rulings and all these cases and all these, you know, you and I talked before the podcast, you know, we kind of standardize that, hey, there's this FDA rule. And then, it's this guidance document. You're not real big on guidance documents, are you? So give us like a little 2-second kind of interview on that real quick. What does that and what should it mean for us?
So I people think of guidance documents as the end all and be all. And what I think of guidance documents is really more of what I refer to as a safe harbor. And the idea being that in the end, if something goes really, really wrong, you're going to be in court. And in court, the FDA is just the other party. In which case, the guidance document is what they took as their position, and what they're telling industry that at this time, if industry sticks to the guidance, they will not prosecute. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the only thing that's legal. It simply means that it's what the FDA has deemed definitely acceptable. There is a penumbra of information that falls outside that, which would very easily be truthful. Additionally, the guidance itself almost always starts with the idea that it is not binding on either the industry or the FDA. So to me, guidance documents are useful to understand what the industry's, what the agency's current thinking is. But A, it's often not current. B, it's often a starting point.
Right.
So I see guidance documents as just a jump off point, if you will.
Okay. Okay. And then putting on top of that document, the FDA memorandum, which is the public health interests and First Amendment considerations, right, related to manufacturer communications regarding unapproved uses. It's pretty specific and it's pretty long and there's lots of legalese in it. But when you read through it all, it really does at the end of the day say, you know, you need to be transparent in your sharing of medical information. And that has some implications, whether who can give valid scientific evidence and information and who cannot. So we really want to be able to be as transparent. We don't want to hide any information. I feel that there's more room for, and I've had a lot of these conversations, I feel like there's more room than companies are doing at present that they wish they could be doing in terms of educating and putting, let's say, retrospective studies together or case studies together, doing more publication, because there's such a stigma out there in pure science land, if you will, that, I mean, I met a young woman who was finishing up her PhD and she's like, pharma pays for this and pharma pays for that. Like, there's just that stigma of antitrust that if it has anything to do with pharma, it must be misleading. And that's so not the case. There are so many really hard at work scientists who are absolutely the top experts in their field, and they're KOLs that have been out in the field that maybe now work for these companies, that their patients really are the center of all they do. And they want that information to surface. So, you know, your advice is move forward cautiously, and just let the information come out, but also wait for FDA. And, you know, in this guidance document and in the memorandum, you got Warner Lambert, we got Abbott, we got the cases that you mentioned earlier. Everything is, there's lots of examples in there. I think that from a case-by-case basis, depending on the company and the type of company it is and the type of product it is, proceed with caution is, yeah, it's kind of same old, but, you know, what would your final, I guess, words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom be?
Probably stay tuned.
Stay tuned. What's next? Is there anything coming up that you know of?
I think that the big thing at this point, it sort of died down a little bit, but I think the big thing that will probably happen next is the FDA will put out a proposed notice. And we'll probably see what either a new guidance looks like or a new regulation looks like. And then you'll see a bunch of lawsuits that'll probably come out of that.
Yeah.
The last time the FDA did something like that was in the third citizens petition. They actually responded to that by changing the definition of intended use, which really they put it in the context of tobacco, but industry went bonkers on it because...
Yeah.
What intended use used to basically mean was that we'll just look at what you guys are marketing for, and we're going to consider that to be intended use.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of, I'm making this up, but like line 3 of page 14 on paragraph 4, they put in like, oh, we're going to change intended use to also include anything you know someone else might be using it for. And that dramatically changes the scope of what would be considered off-label marketing or off-label promotion, because suddenly you're now responsible for the actions of others.
Right.
Which really seemed unfair. And the FDA, there's so much hue and cry about it, the FDA had to back off. So this, we know that the FDA is going to try to stick something, put a line in the sand, and we know industry is going to push back. Their only question is, the FDA is going to put a line in the sand for some kind of reaction.
Right. You know, you always think about the FDA coming after the pharmaceutical company if they're not doing something right, or, you know, right. just to keep them within their guidelines and within their boundaries for the safety of patients, of course.
Yep, absolutely.
But you never really think about the industry pushing back against FDA. So it is surprising to hear about some of these cases of companies coming after FDA to fight for rights to be able to give certain amounts of information. This has been an illuminating conversation today. If definitely one that I feel is, you know, it's off the cuff, but it's a little bit, it's a little controversial.
Let me add one more piece to this, because I think that it's a conversation no one really has, and people, the immediate thought process that I know when I talk to my friends who are pharmacists, or to friends who are physicians or other types of clinicians, well, why do we need pharma, as you said, promoting off-label? That seems like a horrible idea. Off-label use, off-label products should be banned. And that sounds great in principle, except you and I have worked in pharmacies, and we've worked in healthcare. Off-label use is extremely common. It's in many cases standard of care.
Absolutely.
And in many cases, industry is the only one who has the most accurate information. Everything else is often just word of mouth and I heard this and whispers. So would you rather get the information
out correctly? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's required to give you all the information by law and by regulation instead of someone who gives you a whisper and a nod. And
right.
I get the idea that there's bias, but you sort of need to see and contextualize the information in a bigger forum. And the courts have come out, and everyone sort of come out with the idea that the cure to bad information is not no information, it's more information.
Right. And you know, to your point, the whole process of writing a standard response document and having it reviewed by a medical, legal, and regulatory team, and
right.
having it written by a scientist that knows it better than anybody else, because that person is most likely a specialist on that right. product within the industry, and is probably one of the top people in the world to speak about it. And then if they're asked a question, which of course now is the unsolicited kind of version of this, that they have these letters written, and they should, by context, be either, you know, basically that's the goal, is eliminating bias, but
right.
if not, you know, eliminating it down to at least 99%, that there's no bias. There's always human bias when any human writes something, right? These aren't being written by computers
right.
that don't have a mind, but you can provide fair, balanced information based on scientific literature or based on something that's been published, whether it's the scientific literature or case studies, et cetera, and then be transparent as to what you're referencing and have that reviewed and have that sent out. And there's some really good information. And there's information that if we do allow it to just be unsolicited, and we're keeping it kind of under light or just talking about it at congresses, then eventually the prescribers are going to get it, but they come about it in a circumvented way. They're getting more of their medical information on Twitter these days than
right.
from the source of the information. So to your point, it really could elevate the entire conversation if everybody learns to play in the sandbox and hold hands together.
There you go. Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Wow. There. Thank you. That was an interesting conversation, maybe controversial for some. I hope people stick with it and click on all the links below and let us know what you thought. Follow me, follow Darshan, and let us know what you thought. And you know, when new stuff comes out, we'll give you some updates. Thank you, Darshan. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the V3 Podcast, part of the ACMA Podcast Series, in collaboration with the Pharmacy Podcast Network. For all of the ACMA podcasts, please go to acmapodcast.com.